Hello.
Hello, Mr. Giles.
How are you?
Very good. How you doing?
Excellent. Yeah, good.
Welcome back, everybody, to the No Illusions podcast. My name is Cameron Riley. With me is Richard Giles. You're speaking at a conference today, mate. What's that all about?
It's Media 140, which does the rounds. It started, I think, in England, but Andy, the guy that runs it, has taken it around the world because I don't know. That's what he likes to do, and we had it yesterday, and today are the workshops. So today's workshop that I'll be doing is gamification.
What's that mean?
So it's using game mechanics to help with, in my case specifically, internet and mobile type strategies. So adding it can be as simple as adding badges and points and leaderboards and things like that, or it can be a bit more complicated and actually be a bit more useful and add fun and functional features to something that people are building so that people go back and use it more often. And that's the aim. So making it compelling for people to use a service because they actually enjoy it. And that sort of I'm giving a rough outline of how you'd be able to do that.
Have you got any good examples of that actually working? I mean, what obviously comes to mind for me is Foursquare, and while the whole badges and mayor thing of Foursquare was fun for a little while when it started, I and a lot of people I know kind of got over it fairly quickly. And has it continued to be a successful strategy for them?
I think it has, but I understand exactly the reason why you're not interested. And in fact, as soon as it came out, I think I came out and said that I thought it was fairly useless, mainly because of the end result, right? I mean, you can't just use gamification to promote something that's not particularly useful. So what's the end result of using Foursquare? It shouldn't just be a game where you get badges. It should actually provide some other function, and it's getting there, I think, but it's just hasn't got there yet in that it recommends places for you to go. Just doesn't do it seamlessly for me. I mean, most people, one of the things I outline in the presentation is that most people are lazy, and so if they've got to check in every time they go somewhere, I mean, that sounds trivial to a lot of people, but in reality, most people don't care. Most people don't want to do that sort of stuff. Whereas that's why I carry on about Google Latitude, because I think, although people shy away from signing up to a service like that, when somebody knows how to sell a service like that, it'll be used more often because you don't need to check in anywhere. It just monitors where you are at any particular point in time. But there's a heap of examples. I mean, they go from the really simple things like in LinkedIn, when you're filling in your profile, you get a status bar that says how much you filled out. And for some reason, that's really compelling. You've kind of got to get it to 100% or you feel like you're less worthy. Through to
That's
some
just
fight.
where we need more mechanisms making people feel like they're less worthy.
Less worthy. Yeah,
That's what
just want
society
everybody.
really needs right now.
But when you get to 100%, you feel worthy, though, don't you? So there's simple things like that which do actually work. They make things compelling. And I'm just being laughed at by the guys in the office. I'm in like a fishbowl sort of area, and they're just wandering around laughing at me.
But
And
I get what you're talking about with Foursquare. There's got to be a payoff, and I think one of the ways that Foursquare's their model falls down is that there's not enough businesses, at least here in Brisbane, might be different in other geographies, but there's not enough businesses that have actually built in some sort of real world payoff for checking in at their establishment or being the mayor or whatever it is. And so if there's no genuine payoff, it kind of falls flat after a while. What's the point?
It's very true. I mean, I was wandering around the city the other day, I think, and noticed that Borders, because I was interested to see whether or not it closed down or not yet, and it was closing down that weekend. But I noticed in the notes in someone's Foursquare check-in was the fact that you can't redeem the voucher at Borders that Foursquare claims that you can. So it literally has, you go there and it says, Well, you check in here 3 times and you get 10% off your next book, which doesn't matter anyway because you buy a book and you get you can get 10% because they're giving stuff away anyhow. but it apparently they wouldn't redeem that voucher. So kind of, you know, in Perth, in Queensland, a whole bunch of places, it's going to be useless. And that this is part of the problem, right? With any tech company, is does it ever make that leap? You know, will it cross the chasm between Uber geeks and the rest of the world actually using it? And that is when you need to make it really simple and functional. You know, you can add as much fun as you want and make it a game, but it probably still isn't going to cross that chasm until you fix those problems too. And that's a business requirement. Any business has got to sit down and look at what benefits they provide to their customer. And yeah, I'm not sure that Foursquare's quite there yet.
Yeah, you know, I think there is a lot of value in integrating aspects of game theory into marketing, and I guess that's where all of this is leading. These are all experiments in how we apply game theory, because it can be quite compelling. I mean, the best example I can think of from my recent experience is actually in a game, which is something like Call of Duty Modern Warfare, where every time you achieve a new level in the game, if you're playing online multiplayer, you get access to new weapons, and you get badges as well, but you also get access to new things, so there's a genuine payoff in the game environment. But how we integrate that into business to keep people interested is a challenge, and something that I think about with our businesses a lot too, with Podomo, etc. I'm always thinking, okay, how can we integrate real world rewards? And it's, I mean, it's a non-trivial thing. It'd be great to have some examples or some, best practices there that we marketers could learn from.
Yeah, and that's the aim of my workshop, is to provide a bunch of knowledge and tools that can be used, but it can only facilitate somebody who actually understands where the business needs to go and what the business has got and things like that, because you can't just add game mechanics to a website or a business that's not meeting, you know, the real business requirements. But there's other good examples, probably linked to a video if we can, of the VW Fun Factory stuff, where a guy came up with the speed camera lottery. Have you seen that video?
No, speed camera lottery.
Yeah, so if you do a search for speed camera lottery, you'll get a video that was done, and it's somebody came up with the idea that if you have a camera and a speed, it shows the speed that cars are traveling. That, you know, that we see that around town all the time. But this one, what would happen is, if you were speeding, you would get fined, which we're all kind of used to, I think. But if you were doing the right speed or under the right speed, you actually went into the lottery to win money. And they demonstrated, you know, a significant decrease in speeding in that particular area that they put it. Now, got to question the exact science in measuring it, but, you know, it's still an interesting theory, and it shows that you can apply game mechanics outside of technology and games and all of that, and you can actually apply it to something that that has some real world benefits.
So let me clarify here. It's not the people that got caught speeding that went into the lottery. It was the people.
That's correct. Yes, that might have inspired the wrong type of actions.
I thought that was a good payoff. It's like, okay, well, you get a speeding fine, but.
But you also go into the lottery. So and the more you're speeding, the more chances you get to win.
To win.
Yeah, no. And there's an interesting book which I haven't read, but I've seen the details that come out of it. And I'm not even going to try and pronounce the guy's name, but the book is called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. And it's used in every example anybody ever talks about game mechanics, where what you're trying to do is put the player into this optimal place where they're not feeling too anxious, but they're not bored. And so you've got to find this channel. And the thing is that over time, they get more skill, and so you need to also make it a little bit more difficult. And so you've got to find this balance. And when they're in this area of flow, you don't even notice time passing by. You're that involved in the game or the process or whatever it is you're doing. You know, time doesn't matter. Nothing matters. You're enjoying it so much because, you know, there's a little bit of challenge but not too much that's stressing you out. So there's all of these things. I talk about a bunch of different things and tools, and probably more a thing to get people thinking rather than, you know, get them to a point where they can build anything significant. And I certainly don't go into how to build games in real detail because that's, you know, years and years of experience that people need to build, and I don't have that.
It's a really interesting concept, though, getting back to the speeding example, of applying a carrot versus a stick mentality for changing behavior. Instead of saying we're going to punish you for behavior X, you say we're going to reward you for behavior Y. Which activates different parts of the brain and gets different hormones being generated for, you know, because we're all evolutionarily designed to seek approval and seek reward. It's interesting.
And then you've got to go into what, you know, there's the type of people as well, because not all people are affected in the same way by different methods in producing these things. So, you know, there's several different types of, broadly, there's several different types of gamers as well. And so I'm more interested in achievements and being the first to achieve them, whereas somebody else is more interested in exploring, and then somebody else is more interested in just killing as many people as they possibly can before they get killed. And so there's all these, that's the beauty of game mechanics, is you really have to start to explore the psychology of people rather than the technology itself. And, you know, it gets people stepping back and having a look at their customers, or, you know, whoever it is you're trying, because it might be an internal project, so it might be employees. You've got to step back and say, what's going to motivate them, which any parent will understand.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting stuff, Rich. I'll have to get a copy of this book, Flow, and I'll look that up. All right, let's get on to the news, man. We've started a new thing this week, a shared Evernote note, with all of our links in it, which has been fun, except when we were both working on it at the same time about half an hour ago, and I kept getting sync difficulty errors popping up, conflicting changes.
I also tried to use it. I tried to use it on the web and added a whole bunch of things, and they didn't get added. And so then I had to go into the actual app itself on my Mac and then add them in there, and then they updated. So, yeah.
Wow. I didn't realize you had the web version.
Well, it just wasn't working for me. Maybe it's Google Chrome. Who knows?
Who knows? Good old Chrome. Well, let me start with something, if I may, just before we get into actual news story, something that I'm into this week. I've been reading a book by a guy called Will Bunch that's a couple of years old, but it's called Ronald Reagan, Tear Down That Myth. And it's sort of looking at the Reagan years, the Reagan presidency, and looking at the sort of mythology that's been built up about Ronald Reagan by the Republicans, particularly in the last sort of 20 years. And actually looking at the facts about the policies that he put into place and the effect that they had on the U.S. economy, on, you know, the fall of Soviet Russia and things like that he's normally given credit for. Really interesting book. It's regarded as being fairly well balanced, so it's not a complete attack on Reagan. You know, we see this at the moment with you know, particularly what's happening in the U.S. Trying to raise their debt ceiling, Obama negotiating with the Republicans, trying to figure out, you know, what they need to sign up to. And, of course, the Republicans are going back to that Reaganomics policy of continuing to reduce taxes, refusing to raise taxes to get more income in. But when you actually, because that's something that Reagan famously did, his pretty much his first day in office, I think he signed off a massive income tax decrease. But when you actually look at the facts about Reagan's presidency, it's easy to see that there was a lot more damage done in terms of the American economy than there was good, particularly if you look at all of the deregulation of the financial markets that he was responsible for starting the process on, and you look at where that led to today, with the root cause of the GFC a few years ago was pretty much this deregulation of the financial markets. So a really good book for anyone who wants to get a better understanding of the Reagan legacy. Of course, the other major concern that I've always had about Reagan, apart from the things that he did to Nicaragua and Panama and Grenada, etc., was the way that he aligned the Republican Party with the religious right. And, we're starting to see elements of that in Australia in the last decade or so. A lot of our political parties starting to align themselves with the rise of the religious right here as a political entity, something that's kind of new in Australia. Good book. Will Bunch, Reagan, Tear Down That Myth. I saw a good chart too that I'm just looking for in Twitter because, oh, here we go. Yeah. It's a chart from Wikipedia that's not in our show notes. I'm sorry, mate. But if you look at, the Republican economic policies and the impact that's had on the U.S. economy, one of the big things that happened during the Reagan era is for the first time in American history, under Reagan, the U.S. went from being a creditor nation, so a nation that loaned money to other countries, to a debtor nation. During the 8 years of Reagan's presidency, the increase in debt to GDP in the U.S. went up by 20%. And then under George H.W. Bush's presidency, the next 4 years, it went up another 13%. Then under Clinton, it came down by 10%. And then under George W. Bush, it went up another 28%. So, you look at the situation they've got themselves in today where they're effectively bankrupt as a nation. $14 trillion debt, $1 trillion deficit. And then you trace that back to which administrations were responsible for sending the country spiraling out of control financially. It wasn't the Democrats, it was the Republicans. And yet the Republicans are the ones that try and sell themselves as being fiscally conservative. And it also ties back to, local stuff too. When you're discussing in Australia with the people of the right wing that like to push ideas about cutting taxes, you look at what's happened in the US every time you've had a Republican administration, first under Reagan and Bush 1 and then under Bush 2, that's pursued policies of massive tax cuts. What it's led to is massive economic debacles. And under Reagan, of course, you had the savings and loan collapse, you had the stock market crash of 87, then under George W. Bush, we had the global financial crisis, the biggest financial crisis in 70, 80 years. When you actually look at the flow-on effects of the policies of right-wing Reaganomics, see that.
I'm going to show my real ignorance here, and I understand GDP and all that, but when it says that somebody's in debt, they're obviously in debt to another nation. Is that right?
Yeah.
Or nations, right? So they've gotten something from another nation, and they owe them. So surely somebody's sitting on a bunch of money somewhere.
You mean other nations?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I think
every time the news talks about a nation, it sounds like it's in debt.
Well, I don't know the full position on China's economic status, but I know that they're the single biggest creditor nation to the US now. I think something like $1 trillion of treasury bonds, US treasury bonds, China's sitting on.
Gotta love that.
Yeah, the communists in China.
That's right. Own commie bastards essentially own the whole of the US. And they own Australia, let's face it.
Yeah, and one of the other things, again, I've been plugging Matt Taibbi's book, Griftopia, a lot for the last month or two. In his book, he talks about how the US over the last few years have been selling off major pieces of domestic infrastructure, like highways and parking meters and all that kind of stuff, to what are known as SWFs, sovereign wealth funds. And they are typically Arab oil sheiks that package up their, you know, billions of dollars into these things called wealth funds that then go and buy up investments. And they're buying up the US. They buy, you know,
the infrastructure of the US, no less.
Yeah, cities and states in the US that are bankrupt. selling off their infrastructure to Arab sheiks who are buying it lock, stock, and barrel. So the US is going to be owned by the Arabs and the Chinese. And also, there was a great story a little while ago. I think, again, Taibbi was pushing this. It's come out that Goldman Sachs at one stage a couple of years ago tried to sell some major pieces of US infrastructure to a sovereign wealth fund. Actually, they did sell to a sovereign wealth fund that was owned by Gaddafi, and they lost like $1 billion of Gaddafi's money. So you know, that's got to be a worry. Yeah. I think they paid him back out of their own money. Speaking of Matt Taibbi and Wall Street, I put a link up this morning. I heard about this the other day on Democracy Now. This is the J.P. Morgan Chase fine. And J.P. Morgan, obviously one of the big investment banks, one of the oldest and the biggest, and were very much involved in the mortgage crisis. And like Goldman Sachs and all of these organizations, Morgan Stanley, they're continually getting caught breaking the law, fraud, you know, lying to Congress, you know, just a never-ending series of things that they get caught. But the same thing happens every time. It's just happened in the last week with JP Morgan. They got caught up in a bid rigging scheme, or they got caught out, I guess, for having been involved in a bid rigging scheme involving municipal bonds. And so what happened is what always happens. They got fined. They got a slap on the wrist. This was a fine of $228 million. But as usual, they didn't have to admit guilt. I'm looking for, it says from the SEC, the Security Exchange Commission's press release. It says, without admitting or denying the allegations in the SEC's complaint, JPMS has consented to the entry of a final judgment, enjoining it from future violations of Section 15, Subsection C, Subsection 1, Subsection 8. And they pay a fine. So they make billions of dollars in, you know, rigging this municipal bond scheme. And when they get caught out, they get a slap on the wrist, pay a couple of $100 million, which is like a day's work, and don't have to admit to any fault or any guilt, and they get off scot-free to go back and do it again. And as Matt Taibbi points out in his excellent article in Rolling Stone, he says if the defendants had been a bunch of Italians from Howard Beach, they'd all be facing RICO charges and would be looking at years in prison plus seizure of all their ill-gotten gains in addition to civil suits and penalties. But because they're an investment bank, they just get off with a slap in the wrist.
And also you could probably say that if they were innocent, they probably would say, no, we don't want to pay the fine. So the mere fact that they paid it but didn't have to admit it sort of says they've admitted it but have been let off with, as the article suggests, just a nice slap on the wrist.
Of course, a bit like Michael Jackson settling child molestation charges without admitting to anything out of court. It's always a sign of guilt. But yeah, so and this is the problem with the financial system in the US is, or one of the problems, one of, well, you know, the other one is everything's just been, all of the checks and balances have been eradicated over the last 30 years since Reagan, and including the Clinton administration, they did as well. So there's no checks and balances there as there used to be, you know, that were set up after the great crash of 29. And so what we've seen since Reagan is just a continual series of banking industry collapses. They have huge excesses where they make hundreds of billions of dollars of profit, then they crash the whole system, get bailed out by the taxpayer, and then go back to doing it all over again. But this is the other thing. They just, when they get caught out, they don't get punished. They get a slap on the wrist, no admission of guilt, and then they just walk off into the sunset to do it all over again.
Wow. We don't have to worry about it for too long because at some point the US is going to become a communist state of China and they'll be brought into line.
When Obama got elected, I was referring to him for a while as the latest governor of a Chinese province, yeah. I guess the other thing that we don't have in the notes that we should talk about is what's happening to Rupert Murdoch this week.
Yeah.
My God, hasn't that just cracked wide open, the whole Murdoch papers scandal?
It has, and I like to think it's because of this podcast.
Really? You think we can take credit for that?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt that now the Prime Minister is talking about investigations and stuff just because you said something about it, Cam.
Well, I've been calling out the mainstream media for many years, as you know, Rich, and
the pressure finally has worked.
Yeah, it's you know, if you make enough prophecies, eventually, you know, one of them's got to come true.
One of them comes right.
I guess the big question is you know, what's going to happen now? I mean, at the moment, it's isolated to his UK papers, but now apparently the FBI are beginning an investigation to see whether or not they were trying to tap into the voicemails of American 9/11 victims. And, you know, there's some suggestion by Gillard that there should be an investigation into their practices in Australia. You know, you have to think that if this was standard operating procedure for the British arm of news and was working for them, that it would get rolled out across the organisation. I mean, it's hard to imagine that it wouldn't have, right?
Yeah, I mean, the people that are going to be responsible for it are going to be talking with their counterparts everywhere, right?
Yeah, and, you know, the most recent editor of News of the World, Rebecca Wade / Brooks, ended up becoming, is she the chairperson of, or the CEO of News International, or one of those senior titles. So, you know, she's now running all of News's international operations. Absolutely no way in hell she wasn't saying to the Australian and American heads of their various media properties, look, this is how we do it, this is how we did it in England, and this is how you're going to do it.
Mm. I heard a great, or read a great interview with Mitnick. Kevin Mitnick, who was the hacker that got jailed, I don't know how long ago, 10 years or so ago.
Yeah.
Probably more now. And I think he's been the longest person that's been incarcerated or something for hacking. But
still
he's
not
out
allowed
now.
To use a computer.
Yeah, he's ridiculous levels of things that he can't do. But he must be able to do something because the journalist that was having a chat with him asked him how easy it was, and while he was on the phone, Kevin put him on hold and then brought him back on the line, had dialed up the journalist's voicemail, spoofed his mobile phone number, and was listening to a voicemail that the journalist had deleted the night before.
That he deleted? Holy shit.
Yeah, apparently. So, yeah, fascinating stuff. So, I mean, and Mitnick was saying, you know, that just script kiddies with their scripts can probably work out how to do this kind of stuff. I mean, it probably takes a bit more than that, but at least essentially if you understand how to spoof phone numbers, then away you go, because that's all it takes. It just, all the system looks for is what number you're calling from. If you're calling from the number that, you know, it drops into that voicemail. So it's not tight security for voicemail, that's for sure.
So what do you think happens now to Murdoch? Do you think he's going... I mean, he's pulled himself out of many sticky situations in the past. He's known for that. Do you think there's any chance in hell that he's going to walk away from this?
I'd say he would, just like all the bankers do and stuff like that in the US. You know, the usual tactic is to delay, right? So they'll keep it delayed for a year or two, and then everybody will forget whatever happened, and they'll go on their merry way. Yeah. So,
the one thing he's got going against him this time, though, and I'm not sure about this, is the rest of the media empires would love to pull him down a notch. But then the question is, so they might go after him and keep it in the headlines, unless they're also guilty of similar practices.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, if there's an investigation, they're probably going to be investigated as well. And do they want to be?
Yeah. I mean, obviously what's going on in the UK is now involving Blair and Brown and David Cameron and, you know, their various senior personnel, like David Cameron's former press secretary, I think Andy Coulson. Yeah, and, you know, if it starts to have the ability to make governments look bad and their senior political personnel look bad, it's probably all going to get hushed up at some stage. But I don't know. I've got a sense that this is they've got the smell of Murdoch blood now. They're not going to let go.
It'd be fun to watch, that's for sure.
I met Rupert Murdoch once. Have I ever told you that
story? Did you? I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah, I did. 2000 at in Sydney, Bill Gates was in town and threw a special function where he had the Leonardo da Vinci Leicester Codex on display.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Something that Bill owned. And we threw a little invite-only dinner party in Sydney. There was about 100 people there. But I went I had a table that I was hosting. Had the CEO of Netscape and Yahoo and people like that there at the time. Anyway, Rupert was there. Lachlan was there and Sarah O'Hare. I got the chance to chat to Sarah O'Hare for half an hour pre-dinner drinks, which was something else.
But, which is personally more interesting than meeting Murdoch. But anyway, carry on.
I tell you, man. Yeah, she was a very good looking lady. But so then after dinner, everyone left. But Bill was still there and Rupert was still there, and there was sort of half a dozen people hovering around Bill, and I went up and hovered around Rupert and got to say good day and shake his hand and just sat there, you know, sort of chatting and listening to, I can't even remember what, but he was holding court about something. And fascinating experience. I think we were talking about Rudy Giuliani last week, and you asked me if he exuded power, and he didn't. But Rupert was one of those guys that just exuded power. And there was just, I don't know, something about him that just, you knew that this guy was could make or break governance. You know?
Yeah, cool. All right,
your turn for a story. What do you got?
Well, I wanted to avoid having to talk about Google this week, but you kind of got to when they make a big announcement about how much money they're making. So they've made a whole bunch of profit. So they announced it last night or yesterday or today or whatever time zone you might be in, or last week, depending on how quickly Cameron gets the podcast out. And so they've made a bucket of profit. They've actually exceeded expectation. People are saying they're sort of back on track because last quarter they didn't do as well as everybody kind of predicted they would. And so everything's looking very rosy for them. And now, obviously, they're still making all their money out of search and making money out of advertising. But they've also got some pretty good strategies, and people are actually back in favor and saying buy the stock, and because Android's working for them. And then, of course, Google Plus, everybody's sort of saying that that's wonderful because what they do, they've got 10 million users of it and 1 billion items shared, which to me is fascinating because we now know exactly how many geeks there are in the world.
They've got 10 million users in 2 weeks on Google Plus. The interesting thing about their revenue announcement, I thought, is in, if you go back 2 years ago, for the second quarter in 2009, their revenues were $5.5 billion. Their revenues for quarter two, 2011, were just over $9 billion. So they've nearly doubled their revenues in 2 years. I mean, everyone thought Google was a massive organization 2 years ago, but to have doubled their revenues in 2 years, I mean, their year-on-year growth alone is 32%. You know, Q2 in 2010, it was $6.8 billion. Now it's up to $9 billion. But they've come from, I mean, what other organization of that size has doubled, almost, well, I mean, it's not double, it's probably 85%, has had that kind of revenue growth in the last 2 years? Maybe Apple? I don't know, but it's insane.
Yeah. And so to me, it, you know, everybody kind of, we all kind of look at the internet now and go, yep, it's here, you know, we've established it now. But I think it's really just crossed over. I think we're only just starting to see its use. You know, traditional media still gets most of the buying power. So, you know, when somebody goes to advertise, they still do it on TV and they still go to newspapers and magazines and stuff. They don't, a small part of the budget is actually digital. But I think that we'll see that change, especially now with mobile becoming more prevalent. People are using that, and there's some tools that people can use for location, and it becomes more personal and all of these kind of things. I think we're just seeing this shift. I mean, another thing that I've noticed as well, now starting work with Adaptr and going and speaking to people about mobile, you know, I started with a company, well, let me see, when was it? It was about 96, I think it was. I went and worked for a company called Access One, which was an internet service provider, but it was mainly focused on corporate customers.
You worked so at we Access would go One? Out.
Yeah, yeah.
Get the fuck out of here. I never knew that.
Yeah, yeah. For about That's, 6 months, I think so it was.
When I was working at Aussiemail, you were working at Access One, and then Aussiemail bought Access One.
That's right. They did, yeah. Now, I wasn't there when Aussiemail bought, but the Access One guys knew what they were doing. They were actually preparing themselves to be bought by somebody like Aussiemail. And then yeah. Aussiemail got bought by iiNet. And the funny thing is that before I was working with Access One, I was working for a company called Microweb, which was doing, you know, websites and web pages, who also got bought by Aussiemail. So, yeah, everybody kind of got bought by everybody back then. But when you went out, and you would know this, when you went out and spoke to a company in 96, I think it was 96, and said, we've got a, you can connect up to the internet, they're all like, I don't know that we need to, you know. But it was a real struggle to explain to a company the benefits of getting an internet connection in their office.
I can actually remember a conversation with an MIS manager back around then about getting email for their employees, and him actually saying to me, why would I ever need to get email? If they want to talk to somebody, they have a telephone. He actually said there's no reason we would ever need to give our employees email. So yeah, yeah. I totally understand.
It was, and in fact, a couple of years before that, I was at university doing marketing and computers. I went and saw, because I thought, I've got to get my head around the internet, and I saw that we had a course at the university on TCP/IP, and I thought, I'll go do that. So I went and had a chat with the lecturer, and I said, I'm thinking of doing this. And literally, I'm not joking, when he said to me, the internet is just a fad.
This is the lecturer. But anyway, this is the lecturer that was teaching TCP/IP.
That was teaching TCP/IP, telling me that the internet is just a fad. Anyway, so back then it was like really hard explaining to people why they needed the internet. Now, I go into places all the time now to talk about mobile strategies, and I don't have to explain why people need to think about mobile. I literally don't. People are saying, yeah, I've got my iPad and I do this, and I've got my phone and my kids use it, and we buy apps, and, you know, everybody knows about Angry Birds and this, and, you know, did you get this latest? Everybody knows about it. You don't have to talk about it at all. There is no sales whatsoever. And so I think we've only, and to be honest with you, I still think it's just the start. We've only just kind of flipped over, and it's now starting to gather momentum. And people like Google and Apple are in the perfect spot to take advantage of this. So I think we're only just sort of seeing the start of Google taking off.
I totally agree. I get frustrated on a regular basis with how immature the services that are on the net, not the people on the internet, we know they're all immature, but the services on the net, you know, there's so many things that we should be able to do today that we've been talking about for 10 years. I can remember Microsoft's famous Steve Masters video in 2000. It came out where the guy, you know, gets hit by a bike messenger crossing the street, falls down, picks up his phone, rings doctor back in New York, and he's in LA, he's a doctor in New York. Doctor says, yep, I'll just pop open here and find the nearest doctor to you that's got a half hour slot available in their schedule. And she brings up like a calendar and it shows all the free busy spaces. And she goes, okay, there's a doctor here. I can see from his profile that he already accepts your health fund. I'll make a booking for you. Right, you're booked in 10 minutes. He said, can you call me a cab? She says, honey, it's already on the way. We know where you are from the GPS of your phone. I mean, all of this beautiful connected vision stuff that we've been talking about for at least a decade, we're nowhere near pulling all that shit together yet.
No, that's right. And we all thought it was going to happen, you know, imminently. And it kind of has taken a while because business takes a while to mature, and, you know, it's going to take a while still because that's just the way it works. But anyway, if you're keen to make some money, I reckon in the next few years, go and buy some Google and Apple stock because I reckon they've still got some room for growth.
What's Google share price at the moment? Like $1,000 a share or something?
Probably. I haven't looked because I can't afford to go and buy any. But I don't know. Let's have a look. I know it went up after hours.
We've been doing the show for 42 minutes and we've done two stories. I think we need to keep going. You're testing
$528.
You're testing a VPN, Rich. Why?
Yeah, well, a few weeks back I read this really interesting article. Where was it in, Cam? I can't remember the newspaper.
News.com.au.
God, I shouldn't be reading that crap. But anyway, yes. It essentially said that because of the, is it called dual import laws or dual, whatever it is, we're technically, it's not illegal for us to go and grab stuff from the US that is available in the US and say stream it. Saying that, there's probably a whole bunch of legal implications to do with, you know, terms and conditions and all that crap. But let's ignore that part of it. I guess I've been thinking for a little while, you know, why don't I give it a bash? Because I know a whole bunch of people that do set up a VPN to the US so that it looks as if...
Including me. I've been doing
that
for a long time.
Yeah. So, and a bunch of people do. And so essentially all it does is sets up your computer so that your computer is appearing to come from the US when it gets queried by one of these services, like, say, Hulu or
Netflix.
Netflix and Spotify and any of these companies.
Comedy Central, so you can watch the day.
Yeah, any of the media companies over there. So, because you can't stream any shows, right? So, but they can in the US, and there's a reason for that, because they want to make money. But anyway, I thought, bugger it, I'll give it a bash. And I'm surprised at just how simple it is. You literally just go and change a few DNS details, and away you go.
Which VPN did you go with?
Well, I haven't yet. The one that I started using, only because, you know, it was one of the first ones that I sort of had a look at and had a bash, was Unblock US. Mm-hmm. So unblock-us.com. But I haven't decided who I'm going with. I think I've got a free trial for 7 days. That's probably what convinced me to give them a test, just to see how well it would work. Because one of the concerns I had was the speed, because there's a speed hit when you start to use other services. And surprisingly, I don't find it that bad. I mean, the main reason why you would worry about speed is streaming, so video and even music. And it might lag a little bit, but because I'm in Australia and I've got a crap internet service because Telstra's driven all of the other businesses underground, I didn't notice. I think it's all pretty good.
I've been using Strong VPN, about $7 a month for, I don't know, 6 months. And it works fine. I do find that sometimes the connection will sort of get slow or drop out. Then I just have to I disconnect the VPN, reconnect it, get a new connection, you know, refresh the page, and it takes off again. It's fine. But yeah, I mean, it's a terrific experience. You know, we watch, I think, you know, Chrissy and I are in the middle of watching Battlestar Galactica again now. We stream it all from Netflix in the US. When the kids were in my office here over the holidays, they were VPN through and watching Futurama, you know, back catalogs on Netflix. Yeah, it's a terrific experience if you're wanting to watch movies and TV. We everything that we watch now, we cancelled our Blockbuster or Quickflix service, you know, 6 months ago, and just started using this exclusively. It's terrific. There are some things you can't get. Some things, you know, that they don't have available for streaming, but, you know, usually only the latest stuff. There's just, you know, there's just so much there to watch. You could spend the rest of your life and never run out of shit to watch.
Yeah. Now, but so Netflix, you need a US credit card, right, which you probably are lucky to have handy because of relationships you happen to have. Is that right?
We have a US billing address, which is Chris's old billing address, and I think it's an Aussie credit card. I don't think it's a US credit card.
But, so it's just the address that you needed, though.
Yeah, Chrissy already had a Netflix account from when she was in the US, so I just resuscitated that, I think plugged in my credit card, and never had an issue.
Cool.
That's wicked. You know, yeah, it is. It's great. And we just watch it. I don't put it through the TV. I know other friends like Cameron Colley, who Cameron has not the Apple TV, he has the one of those other ones, little box with a cut off corner. I can't remember what it's called.
Boxy.
Yeah, he's got a Boxy box. And I know that he does the same thing. He's a guy who first told me about it, actually. And he streams it through to his TV and watches everything on the big flat screen. I don't have a TV, so we just do it on the MacBook and lie in bed with the MacBook set up and just watch shit. It's fine. It's definitely the future of this kind of stuff. Although I remember Mark Cuban 5 years ago saying there's no way you could ever stream TV because there's not enough bandwidth for everybody and it'll never work.
Yeah, that's because he owns a bloody great big HD company and wants everybody to use high definition, which actually most people don't care about because you don't even notice it when you're involved in a show or whatever. But anyway, that's talking about Mark Cuban, who's, I don't know.
Rich.
Yeah, rich. Because he got lucky and smart and stuff. Speaking now, just of watches basketball games.
Speaking of Mark Cuban, have you seen the latest K-Swiss ad featuring Kenny Powers?
No.
Oh, God. I need to send you a link for this. If you guys haven't seen it. You ever watched Eastbound and Down?
No.
You don't know who Kenny fucking Powers is? Oh,
I've heard the name.
Oh, he's a legend. Oh, well. Anyway, for those of you that do know what I'm talking about, find the K-Swiss MFCEO video. I'll put a link up on the show notes. Kenny Powers, motherfucking CEO. Anyway, it's very funny. Mark Cuban has a cameo in it. That's what I thought of it. Speaking of hacking shit, the Pentagon has just announced today that 24,000 files were stolen in a cyber attack in March by a foreign government. They haven't said who, but they said they have a pretty good idea who was responsible.
Like 20... China or something.
Yeah, well, attacks in the past they've blamed on China or Russia, but 24,000 files. They haven't really revealed what was taken or who took it, but I just love the irony that the Department of Defense in the U.S. built the internet to protect itself from a nuclear attack, and now it's being used to steal files from the Pentagon.
I think there's probably stacks more that go on. They just can't admit it. It's like a bank, right? Banks don't want to tell everybody that, you know, when a bank gets hacked or something because it's really bad and everybody starts to panic. So my guess is that, and I'm intrigued as to why they're talking about it. Did somebody already know? Was somebody going to leak the information? Because otherwise, why would they bother saying it?
Yeah, good point. And, you know, it happened back in March, and they're just talking about it now in July. So I'd say that, you know, it got leaked to a journalist, and the journalist went there and said, listen, we're going to run this, so you might as well tell us. Yeah. But, you know, it doesn't it kind of blow your mind that the Pentagon, with its trillion-dollar budgets, is still getting hacked? You know, if Hollywood is to be believed, the Pentagon can listen to my conversation from a satellite and track my every movement, and yet somebody's
from the future.
And yet, you know, someone, some government, some backwater communist dirt hole like China or Russia, again, is hacking, you know, the richest nation on Earth's richest division, best funded government department, that's supposed to be armed with the smartest humans and cyborgs ever invented. Like, what the fuck is going on? How does the Pentagon get hacked, man? Like, what the fuck?
Well, it reminded me of an article I read a few weeks ago about, which is titled "Human Errors Fuel Hacking as Tests Show Nothing Stops Idiocy," which I love because, you know,
I read that.
Kind of just goes to show. And the article is essentially saying the U.S. Department of Homeland Security had done some tests and found that if they dropped a USB thumb drive in the parking lot of a government building, that the government workers would pick up the key and go and plug it in to their work computer. And I think it was something like 60% plugged the device into the office computer just to sort of check to see what was on it. And but if they were smart enough to put the logo, an official logo, on the key and drop it in the car park, that would rise to 90%.
Yeah.
So that's all anybody has to do, right? As long, you know, provided that you've got a means to get that information out by, you know, if I don't know if the Pentagon are completely wired, but I'd imagine they're not. You know, there's contained areas that don't particularly have any internet access, but that's just me making massive assumptions based on movies like Mission Impossible and things like that. But, you know, it's true, and that's what Kevin Mitnick talked about, right? You exploit the people, you don't exploit the technology.
Yeah, I think another thing in that study that you mentioned, they sent some emails to employees that had attached Excel spreadsheets with titles like 2011 Recruitment Plan. And people would click on that, and obviously, you know, there'd be some virus or bug in there that would then get into the system and start, you know, monitoring the keys, you know, that are tapped and looking for passwords and looking for, you know, secure access stuff. So,
yeah, it's like the things on Facebook that every couple of days another one of my friends falls for. You know, you put an image on there that has the potential, you know, and a sort of saucy title about some daughter getting discovered by their dad, or, you know, a picture of a woman with her boobs out, and you watch how many people click it, and that's, you know, one of those Facebook viruses that I'm surprised nobody's figured out how to stop yet. But, you know, that it's that simple.
Do they want to stop it? It's probably Facebook, because we all know Facebook is owned by the CIA. Or was it the FBI? It's one of those.
All of them, isn't it? No, they're all owned by China anyway, so.
All right, what else? We got like 7 minutes left, man. What are we going to cover last? You get to pick.
I don't know. Oh, wow, I get to pick. Well, let's talk about, because I don't know nothing about the rest of the stuff, but the one that intrigued me the most was your stuff about the Mormon.
Oh, really? Yeah, shit. Well, you know, this is topical for me because, Chrissy's a former Mormon, her family are mostly Mormons, and we're going to Utah next week. We're going to Vegas next week and then Utah the week after, actually. And I'm going to be surrounded by them. And, yeah, so obviously, I don't know how much you guys all know about the Mormons, the Church of Latter-day Saints, but, you know, it's a pretty crazy fucking religion.
Well, just talking about how it started, I think, is a perfect example of how crazy it is.
I mean,
well, you know, the guy went to the top of a hill or something and had a vision.
It's a little bit more complex and crazy than that. And, you know, I'm sure everyone's seen the South Park episode that gives a very accurate depiction of it. But, yeah, basically Joseph Smith, like in the early 1800s, said that an angel appeared to him, told him to go to this location in upstate New York, and he found buried some ancient plates with mysterious hieroglyphics on them. He translated them by putting magic stones into his top hat, which told him what these mystical plates said. And, you know, he wrote the Book of Mormon. And basically, you know, the story that the angel
told him. And every Scientologist knows that that angel was actually an alien. But anyway, that's another story.
And the story that, you know, that the angel or the book told him was that, that after Jesus left Jerusalem, he actually went to North America and preached to the Native Americans and all this kind of stuff, like crazy fucking story. Anyway, you know, it's so crazy that millions of people believe it. Millions of people listen to that story and go, oh, and no one ever saw the plates, and then they disappeared before anyone could see them and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, listen, people listen to the story and go, oh, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, you know, I don't think they're any more or less crazy than your average Christian. I mean, Christianity is a crazy fucking belief system anyway. There's just
zombies.
One particular crazy cult. Oh, I've got a thing here. I was going to, if we have time, I'm going to play this clip from Robert M. Price's Bible Geek show. But anyway, yeah, so the Mormons have taken the Microsoft approach to marketing. As people probably know, there's a big musical on Broadway at the moment called The Book of Mormon that's written in part by the guys behind South Park. It just won 9 Tony Awards. It's a huge hit. I've been listening to the soundtrack. Chrissy and I have been listening to the soundtrack from it. It's very, very clever and very, very funny. Our favourite song is one called Hasadiga Ibowai, which is sort of a piss take of the Lion King's Hakuna Matata. It's about the musical's about a couple of Mormon missionaries that go to Uganda to try and, you know, proselytize. And they meet this African tribal leader who says, well, you know, whenever bad things happen to us, we just say Hasadiga Ibowai. And they go, oh, really? Does that mean no worries for the rest of our days? He goes, well, kind of. So they sing this whole song that when life's getting you down, just sing Hasadiga Ibowai. And then they reveal later in the song, Hasadiga Ibowai actually means fuck you, God. And then the song goes, if God fucks you in the butt, fuck him right back in the cunt. Fuck him in the ass and fuck him in the eye. Hasadiga Ibowai. So it's pretty funny shit. Anyway, so yeah, they you remember the old Microsoft ads? I am Microsoft. I am Windows. I am Windows or all that kind of shit. The Mormons have done an exact ripoff of that ad. And they've got a bunch of these clips up on their new website, mormon.org. That has regular everyday people talking about their lives and stuff and, you know, quirky little things that they like to do. And then it's like, I am a Mormon. Oh, we're all just such normal, interesting, you know, good old American people. Yeah, and of course, not only are they all fucking batshit crazy, but they have two presidential candidates running in the 2012 election, Mitt Romney and Huntsman. So, you know, they're really gearing up for a major political push. And, you know, the other thing that's really worrying, not really worrying, but one of the things about them that, you know, a lot of people, myself included, really don't like. I mean, what people believe in their own time, really up to them. But when they start massively funding things like Prop 8, as they did in 2008 in California to overturn the gay marriage legislation there, there was another article that I had in the links note. 35 years of prayer couldn't get rid of my homosexuality, says ex-Mormon turned atheist. They have these programs, you know, that they put you into. We've got a friend in the US who grew up in Utah with Chrissy as a Mormon, decided or realized that he was gay in his late teens, and went through electroshock therapy that the church got him into to try, you know, that literally putting electric nodes on his balls and then showing him gay porn and you know, zapping his balls to try and turn him off. And you know, these
days... It has the desired effect on me, that's for sure.
I don't know, you'd start to like it.
yeah, turn and gay this, and enjoy sadomasochism.
And this guy today, you know, he's out of the church, still gay, but has like serious emotional and psychological problems, many of which I suspect come from having his balls zapped by electric wires. But then, of course, we have our own version of this, you know, craziness. I think an article you put up there, which I was going to put up as well, Kevin Rudd's sister.
Yeah.
She's Laurie Rudd, is talking about the global gay Gestapo brainwashing Labor members. Now, we've got four state ALP conferences in Australia that have endorsed changes to legalise same-sex marriage. Unfortunately, the New South Wales Labor, that looked like they were going to do it, refused to back it and said it has to go to the national ALP conference. But she's talking about the global gay Gestapo feeding propaganda and brainwashing people. I mean, what a crazy fucking bitch.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just stupidity, right? It all comes back to fear. Everybody's scared of something and then they'll have a go at people like that. It's just ridiculous. But anyway, doesn't surprise me, really. Family.
I was supposed to do a podcast with Kieran Salzoni again yesterday, but he's crook. You know, I did a podcast with him a couple of weeks ago as he was talking about his polyamory and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But, yeah, it's to get at the heart of what it's based on, I mean, when you have people that just want to love each other and get married and, you know, live a normal life, to try and stop them from being able to do that is a really peculiar form of hatred and loathing. Which is, I have to say, you know, when you read the Old and New Testaments, it's just uniformly a collection of writings about how to be intolerant and hate people. There are snippets of, you know, nice little bon mots, like, you know, love thy neighbor. But then when you read that section, what it's really saying is love your neighbor who believes what you believe and agrees with you. And as a man, because, you know, women don't get any looking. And, you know, it's got to be a man who agrees with you. And if he doesn't agree with you, well, fuck him, he's going to hell.
So. Stone the bastard.
Yeah, but this sort of shit is, you know, what turns people like me against Christians. This kind of just intolerance and hatred and I don't know, something fucked up going on there. And then we could talk about the Catholics and what was the latest story we had this week? Catholic Church to allow access to internal files. Well, there was another story which seems to have disappeared from my notes. What happened to that?
Probably that stupid using the web version of Evernote.
Yeah, you killed it, man. The Catholic Church in Germany is agreed to open up some of its files from the last 10 years to an independent investigator to search for sexual abuse violations. But there was another one, I think, in England. The Church of England just had a major synod, and which is like a, I don't know, gathering, a meeting of the bosses. But yeah, they've said that Church of England could be out of business within 10 years, apparently. Wow. 20 years. Aging Church of England will be dead in 20 years, says the Church of England leaders. So they're just... The average age of its members is now 61, and by 2020, a crisis of natural wastage? What the fuck does that mean? Will lead to their numbers...
Is that their words? That's brilliant. Yeah,
their words. Natural wastage. I'm going to try and use that in a sentence today. So, will lead to their numbers falling through the floor, the church's National Assembly was told. The church was compared to a company impeccably managing itself into failure. The warnings follow an internal report calling for an urgent national recruitment drive to attract more members.
Not also think that it's got to do with that the youth are becoming a bit more savvy and not trusting the church as much as they did decades ago because that was their only choice?
I'd like to think that's the case, but I don't think it is. I mean, I think that they're moving from, you know, one bizarre cult to other bizarre cults. They're joining the Baptist happy clapper movements like here, Hillsong or the City Church thing or they're becoming, you know, Scientologists or Mormons or wacky New Age energy healing believers. I would love to believe that they're getting more rational as time goes on, but I don't know that. I mean, maybe a small percentage, but I don't think the stats indicate that more and more people are, you know, becoming rational thinkers. I just think they're moving from one crazy sect to another crazy sect.
I know we don't have time now, but we should talk about Darren Brown. Have you seen some of his stuff? The one where he goes to the US to convince people that he's a, you know, one of these healers. Have you seen that episode?
No. I don't even know who Darren Brown is.
Darren Brown is brilliant. He's a illusionist is probably the best word, right? But he uses all these techniques, you know, NLP type techniques and hypnosis and blah 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 to do all these tricks and illusions. But he didn't do it because he would have been too well known. But he taught this guy how to become one of these faith healer type, you know, leaders. And took him over to the US to show how simple it was to fool a whole bunch of people. I'll send you the title of the show.
Put it into the show notes for our next show, man, which will be in about a month.
Yeah, okay, cool.
So I'm off to Vegas on Tuesday, be in the US for about 3.5 weeks. I'm actually going to an atheist meetup in Las Vegas on the 22nd of July. I think it'll be fun to talk to the poor Americans. I mean, at least here we've got an atheist prime minister, and about 20% of the population self-nominates as non-religious on the census. In the US, I think it's about 5%. So we'll share with them how we accomplish such wonders. And have a good month, Rich.
Yeah, you too. Have a good trip.
Thanks, mate. All right. I've got to find the button to turn off the recording. There it is. Bye.